wonderful to hear the discussion so far. Again, I'm Wendy Seltzer, and leading our final panel on patents and standards. And I think it's a nice conclusion to the day's discussion, bringing us down to the very specific questions of patents, standards, and their intersection with open source and free software development. One of the questions that I sometimes hear, or the complaints from people in the free software development community, is of how can standards be patented? How can we be expected to interoperate with something and yet be told that in order to do that interoperation, we need patent licenses and patent conditions? And the panelists that I have joining us up front here are going to help explain why the question is much more complicated than that, that in some instances, patents are facilitating standardization. In some instances, those conflicts are not what they seem. And so the folks that I have up here are really going to help us explore the details of how standards processes work and the role that patents play in them. And so I'm thrilled to be joined by John Card, who is Director of Standards and Technology at EchoStar, Jed Carey, Vice President of Video Technology Policy and Deputy General Counsel at Cable Labs, Steve McCuskey, Director of Interoperability and Standards at Microsoft, and Nina Wang, partner at Fagerty & Benson. And again, all of them have distinguished biographies that you can read more about in our program. To start us off, I'm going to ask Steve to give us a short presentation framing some of our discussion of patents and standards.
And how do I get this? Oh, there we go.
Magic.
The standard.
I like Wendy's intro there because I think it did a good job of sort of layering on this intersection of an additional element. Just have this quick slide here that just sort of shows we've been talking about open source and patents. Now we're going to throw a third dimension, and not really a dimension, a third element in there. And what I'd like to talk about is sort of the intersection of these and the interaction. Some definitions, we've already talked about these. What I think is important is really about the technical standard is we're talking about a specification for establishing uniform engineering or technical criteria, often with the aim of facilitating interoperability, as Wendy mentioned. The important issue of interplay, one of the issues that I'd like to tee off, and I think we'll have others that will come out during the course of the roundtable discussion, is really this issue of technical standards may include patented technology such that implementing the standard would require a patent license. For those who don't have this sort of technical standards background, such patents are customarily licensed under what we call RAN terms, reasonable and non-discriminatory terms, which can include either a reasonable royalty or can be done on a royalty-free basis. The area of interplay is that we also know that implementations of these standards can then be released under a range of licenses, under proprietary licenses and under open source licenses. And the key question really is what, if any, interplay is there between the open source license and the RAN patent licenses? I think this is, as I said, it's one of these really interesting issues. There's some perspectives that I've found discussed, including in what little academic literature there is on this topic, and I would suggest that it's a little bit on the vague and overgeneralized side, and what I'd like to do is try to stimulate, with a couple slides I have here, some discussion around are these perspectives really, not necessarily the right ones, but what analysis is being used to look at the intersection between patents, standards, and open source? The common theme that I see is this description that RAND licensing, specifically royalty-bearing patent licenses, discriminate against open source developers. And it's framed a few different ways. I have sort of four ways. I think the key question is really, what was the analysis used to reach these conclusions? In other words, put on our lawyer hats for a second, say, what's the brief look like? What are the claims and counterclaims here? And so one of the things I suggest is there's not a lot of analysis in most of the papers and presentations that I've seen. And so I'd like to at least suggest one that I think starts to tease out what some of the interplay issues are here. And that is whether the OSS license that the distributor, the implementer of the standard, chooses contains a requirement or a limitation or prohibition that precludes that distributor from taking the RAND patent license, including things like royalty. And I'll just end with sort of what I think is some thoughts. So there's two ways of looking at this. One, putting our pure lawyer hats on for a second and saying, let's take the 75 or so open source licenses and let's take sort of what we know is a typical RAND license with a royalty, and let's do the one-to-one mapping and figure out where are the potential conflicts and where are the challenges. And I think if you go through, you'll find that from a licensing standpoint, they're really the vast majority of the licenses are 100% compatible with RAND terms, including payment of a royalty. And it's really only the GPL family of licenses that has this prohibition on third-party patent licensing. And what's interesting is no one should really be surprised about that. I mean, that really is the gist of the GPL, and it was a very intentional decision to sort of put that in there. As one of these authors said, you know, this is sort of a self-inflicted issue, and so we have to think about these two systems coming together head on. It's not necessarily the case that RAND is discriminating against the GPL. It's that there's some tension there between the way these two systems deal with patents. What I'd like to end with is really, you know, these aren't meant to be representative of viewpoints of me or really anyone here. They're just some of the questions that have come up as I've had this exact discussion with academics and practitioners, both on the open source side of things and on the commercial side, and say, you know, what's the real issue here? Is it that the license that I'm using to distribute really prohibits me from taking a RAND license? There really is an actual inconsistency, and I've got a bar here from doing this. Is it I can't afford to pay royalties? I mean, this has come up a couple of times during the course of the day, the idea of the smaller developers who aren't being sued for patent litigation cases, and the assumption is they don't really have the money. They're not an attractive target. That could be another reason. We've also talked about the open source software community having a bit of a philosophical disagreement with software patents as a general matter. And so there's this other potential rationale here, which is I don't like software patents and therefore don't want to pay any royalties in the standards context. And then finally, there's also a number of companies we've talked about today that are quite successful in generating lots of revenue. And to some degree, one of their motivations may be I'd rather not have to pay royalties. I have a business model that's different from your business model. I make money through services, through advertising, through whatever it happens to be. And paying royalties to put a standard into some software I want to distribute, that's a component cost. I just assume not pay that cost, just like car manufacturer would rather not pay for ball bearings or brakes or other components like that. So with that, that's really the gist of what I've presented here, and hopefully that level sets us for a good discussion.
Terrific. Thanks, Steve. And before, as we sort of take people through the standards process, John, I wonder if you want to tell us a little bit about how does one get into one of these standards-making processes? What does that look like?
Well, if I was a Buddhist, I was a very bad Buddhist in my last life. So I'll talk about different classes of standards. There are, in the U.S. at least, a set of standards which are generated by accredited standards bodies. The ANSI, the American National Standards Institute, actually has a document that describes the rules and regulations if you want to become an ANSI accredited standards body. There are some advantages in being an accredited standards body in terms of your members know what the rules are going to be. Your standards are likely to have a life once your organization, if your organization goes away. So to the extent industries want to rely on those standards, there's some more certainty in a standard coming out from an ANSI process. I don't have a document to distribute. It's free on the web. If you go to the ANSI.org website and search for essential requirements, there's a 2008 guidebook that's basically available to ANSI members or the general public to understand what that means. Two main parts of the ANSI process that maybe fit with our discussion today is, one, there's a requirement there be a due process structure for creating these kinds of standards. In other words, if I voluntarily join the effort and I have some input, either I like things, I don't like things, I have ideas, I have other ideas that aren't so great, I have as reasonable a chance as any other member of seeing that the output of the group, that I have the influence on the output of the group. Some of the ANSI bodies will vote strict majority rule. There are two-thirds rules. There are consensus depending on the particular organization. There are a lot of due process organizations that don't operate formally under ANSI rules. For example, the W3C has very much the same kind of operations and publicizes and runs things, but they haven't chosen to become an accredited standards body. The other part of at least what ANSI requires, Steve touched on, and that is some kind of patent policy. And what ANSI had decided is a fair and reasonable patent policy is what Steve called his RAND, reasonable and non-discriminatory. And that is if I am a participant in a standards body and it turns out the standard invokes some patent, to practice whatever the standard is, I have technology and patents that read on that, I have to agree to either license my technology to all comers for the same kind of fee or to offer the technology for no cost. That's a condition of my participation in an ANSI body. There are other bodies and some ANSI bodies that have a more strict rule for participation, and that might be you must agree to license all of your technology or cross-license all of your technology to all other members of the body. That can work. That's kind of some of the framework that at least defines the formal standards community in the U.S. A lot of the standards that touch on software necessarily touch on the internet, touch on interconnectivity. Many of those standards came up through the IETF, the RFC's request for comments, some of which are now decades old. A lot of the reason why those standards exist has to do with DARPA and government funding to see that the internet came into being. Al Gore or whomever it was that was the father of the internet, the reason for those standards. And so there's a lot of, I suspect if today somebody wanted to go out and build a parallel to the internet, there would be, in today's climate, many more kinds of patents suddenly showing up in the process. Maybe 802.11 is a good example of a communication standard that operated decades later and went through something completely different. Lastly, looking at the open source communities and the standards communities, I will admit standards engineers speak strange languages. We use lots of acronyms. We think about problems a little bit differently than a lot of engineering disciplines do. So there is a translation effort that's kind of required to speak about in two standards. But in reality, the rules are very much parliamentary. Knowing Robert's Rules of Order is, in fact, a very handy skill set to have if you're going to be involved in formal standards work, because that's oftentimes what's used to ensure due process. So to the extent that there is a tension between standards and open source, in some sense, open source is the idea of here's what I've done, here's what I've created, or maybe here's what this community has created, come help, let's grow this, let's make it better, let's find a better way to do it. Whereas in standards, you're necessarily saying, here's the problem I want to solve one way. And I want to exclude all of the other maybe great ideas, but I do want to settle on, for interoperability or safety or other reasons, only one way to solve this problem. So there's a tension between the inclusive nature of the end product and the exclusive nature of the end product in standards. But behind the scenes, a standards body is going to only work best when it has contributors who are actively coming in and saying, I understand the problem really well, here's my solution, here's another solution. Let's compare them. Let's find the best solution at the end of the day. Because of that process, sometimes some of the technologies are patented. If a standards body decides to actively stay away from patents, they can do that. But every now and then a company will have a patent and they weren't a member of a body. There is a friction. There's a problem there that's got to be resolved. And most standards bodies, again, through disclosure, do the best they can to make sure that the rules are level.
So thank you. So you've sort of hit on a couple of the functions of these standards bodies. They're trying to coordinate for interoperability and sometimes to choose one among several options. And then through their intellectual property policies, they're often trying to sort of flush out all of the patent claims that might be relevant, identify the essential claims so that they can at least tell people, here's what you need in order to interoperate with this standard. Now, Nina, you're a litigator.
Right.
How well does that work in practice?
You know, I think in the actual practice of litigation, standards are really challenging. I think John touched on it in part because there are all these standards that have been developed for one reason. The 802.11 standard is a great one. It was initially developed for wireless communication in manufacturing, so that when you were building things, you wouldn't have wires running across your floor. Well, it's now the dominant standard for wireless communications, whether it's in homes or offices. And so you have, and it's transitioned several times, as many of you probably know, in the 20 years that it's been around. So you start with a standard that's for one purpose and has a group of people working on that standard or a group of companies. 802.11 has a patent policy where they're very adamant that you come as an individual member of IEEE. You're not voting as a company, although in reality we all know that if you're sending your engineer from your company, they're not really voting as, John Doe. They're voting as John Doe engineer for Microsoft. So in the challenge of litigation, I think it's the shortcutting of, of a company saying, I have this patent portfolio, and all they have to say to establish Rule 11 basis for litigation is that my patent is essential to your standard, and because your product practices that standard, you therefore infringe. I think it becomes much more complicated in the litigation context, and that shortcut doesn't really work, and you end up having sort of sub-litigations about what is essential, what does the standard actually say. Even though it's a standard is one way to do things, patent claims may be much more narrow in terms of it's one subset of ways. And so it actually, in my experience, has made litigation much more complicated as opposed to sort of what you would think, which is, okay, if you're essential to the standard and I comply with the standard, then you infringe. There's a lot more complexity than that.
Thanks. Now, Jack, you were talking when we discussed the questions earlier about the OCAP standard that Cable Labs has been developing.
I'll give a couple comments on what both John and Nina have said, because there are other ways to develop standards too, and maybe Cable Labs is one of the examples. We're actually a consortium owned by the cable industry. We establish what we would call specifications versus standards, but we do send a lot of our specifications to standards bodies. But primarily how we establish the IPR rules is through contract. To join and help draft these specifications, you sign on to an IPR agreement that has specific terms, generally royalty-free or RAND. You can do RAND. I also have seen more interesting innovations lately to develop a standard, including LLCs, you know, set up an LLC separately that has these elaborate bylaws on IPR and what you can and can't do with the IPR within the LLC and how your licenses are transmitted to other LLC members. DECE Forum is one that we belong to that is an LLC. So it's kind of, there's innovative ways to set up different standards also. And also one other thing to add to your process there is generally in the standards process, if a patent is made known, the chair goes back to that patent owner, if they're part of the committee, and says, will you license this on RAND? Will you license this royalty free? Third option is, or you're not going to license it at all. And if the answer is you're not going to license it at all, then it kind of sends it back to the technical committees to rip that out of the standard, right, if possible, and draft around it, which is also gets to be a very complex effort in the standards body.
Well, and if it's not possible, sometimes that stops the standard.
Yeah, yes, it could. But with respect to certain standards that we have at Cable Labs, OCAP being one of them, I'll tie in the open source end of things. So putting your hat on as a coming from a standards perspective, we write these standards, and then some of our standards have a software component to them, and we generally will develop a reference implementation to go with the specification. Also goes with a test suite and certification process. But the reference implementation, oftentimes we will open source that. Because if you're thinking about it from the standards organization, we want to proliferate that standard. We want to make that standard widely available. We get the network effects of adoption. We get hopefully good ideas from the community, and hopefully we get some maintenance. We're a nonprofit. We don't have the support and maintenance community to offer on our reference implementation. So that's where we bring in the open source end of things to a specification. And then, of course, the third component in your concentric circles is patents. There are sometimes known patents in standards. I mean, MPEG is a good one that a lot of people use MPEG to transport in a lot of their standards. Of course, there's the MPEG LA patent licensing pool. A lot of our standards do too, because they have to do with video. And we know that exists, and we know that actually there's a patent pool out there, but it can still be part of a standard. And we often do put in our specifications requirements to adhere to specifications that have patents behind them.
And so if somebody downloads your reference implementation for this OCAP set-top box middleware, do they get the patents for free?
So you can do this different ways. You could go get the patent license for them. And MPEG of LA, of course, is widely available. A lot of people license that. Actually, it's fairly cheap. I think it's $2.50, or the first 100,000 are free for MPEG 4. You can do that. Another way to do it is in the reference implementation or the download of a software, you could put a stub basically there and say, MPEG 2 goes here, and then they can download it. Then if their computer has MPEG 2 or MPEG 4, then they have it, of course. They would have to get a license. I have seen open source reference implementations for MPEG 4 distributed where the licensor or the website who's running that distribution says, you need to go get a license, but he doesn't have a license himself on an open source basis. So, different ways to do it.
And then how about, you mentioned also the Cable Labs participants have a patent pool for patents on the middleware, on the software.
It's,
I mean, that's an interesting one.
Well, like I said, there are known patents out there on in some of our specifications. Cable Labs does not have any patents in that area, but we do know of a patent pool that already exists to provide patents to that specification. So occasionally those will crop up. I think I was talking with someone the other day, actually with Jason Hazelmeyer at lunch the other day. I think he said no worthwhile standard does not have... we came up with two items, open source, if it's software anyways, and a patent pool behind it. So those are kind of two necessary components or for really making a standard flourish, I think, to take some of the patents out of the field in a patent pool, for more efficient licensing, reduce your transaction costs, and then also reference implementation, of course, in the form of open source helps your standard flourish.
Great. So some of the questions around standards and their interoperability with free software come out of folks on the political side of the free software community who say, free software is about freedom. I should be able to distribute and distribute to end users who will be able to redistribute. That's, I mean, some individual developers, but also some projects like the Mozilla project. Do you see Mozilla wants to be able to distribute a web browser and distribute the source code to the web browser and tell its end users, you can recompile this, you can modify it, and redistribute it. Do you see that as compatible with a standard that includes patents? Say, a standard for web video that includes some patented codecs? Anyone who wants to.
So there's a bunch of different perspectives, and that's maybe one of the things. I don't have a lawyer hat, by the way. I'm not allowed to wear a lawyer hat. I'm not a lawyer. So, but one of the hats that we could wear is a patent holder. And assuming that I've actually developed some technology and done it, let's say, with the good intent of making this work for me, and I've chosen to patent it and disclose it to the world, as a patent holder, I would be surprised and chagrined if someone came along and took advantage of the work that I did without at least recognizing and maybe reimbursing whatever costs I had. Now, we don't oftentimes in society have discussions about how much did it cost you to do XYZ development. It's all shelf price or service price, etc. So to the extent that I developed some technologies that ended up in a web video standard 10 years ago, and I had no idea there would be a web video standard someday and that Mozilla would exist and someone would want to distribute my technologies, all I knew 10 years ago is I've got a patent and I'm willing to license it, and maybe I'm even willing to join a patent pool and license under RAND terms. That's the rules that I thought I was playing under. It is, in some sense, as a patent holder, kind of unfair to see the rules change out from underneath me, and I had nothing to do with it. I did the work. I did it in expectation of here's what the rules were, and now the rules don't apply. So there is a necessary conversation there, and oftentimes that's accomplished through a patent pool or through a license. On the other side, speaking as maybe an open source developer or as anybody who's trying to figure out how to innovate and create new things, to the extent that things become the standard way to do it, that I have to have that codec or I'm just not going to be able to handle 80% of the web video content out there, it's a necessary part of my life to get involved in that icky complexity. Now, I may not like it, and speaking to the previous presentation, there may be good reasons for me not to want to get involved. But at the end of the day, if I'm releasing this to other people and they want me to promise no one will come looking for you, if I can't promise it, I can't promise it. If I want to choose a license and it says I must be able to promise certain things, I better not pick that license. You know, it's unfortunate, but that's kind of where we are at the moment. I find it personally interesting that we have, in the sense of copyright, an idea of fair use, but there isn't yet a corresponding thing for patents. Maybe there's a need there. Maybe over the intervening decades we'll see that as software becomes more and more a part of what we do as engineers and as human beings. So that's why I think we got to where we
yeah.
are.
So I think, I mean, and you will see my... my most recent defense counsel hat on, is I think that patent pools can be very valuable, and I think they make a lot of sense for companies to put patents in the patent pool. As a defendant and as a defense counsel, when you're approached by a patent pool that says, okay, I have 10 patents that are essential to the 802.11 standard or whatever standard that's thousands of pages long, and that's your notice. So I come from it from a litigator's point of view. That's your notice of patent infringement. And then you're left as the defendant trying to figure out why are these patents essential? And all you're told is some third party, probably patent prosecutor in a law firm, made a determination that this patent, one of the claims, and there could be, you know, obviously tens or 50 claims, is essential to this patent, and it could be essential to an optional part of the patent, it could, or an optional part of the standard, it could be essential to a mandatory part of the standard, it could be, you know, it becomes this challenge of, in terms of representing companies that actually make product and innovate, well, 7 cents might not sound like a lot to you, but unless I know these are really essential, and unless I know that then I can throw my product out into the world and be covered, and my customers can be covered, then why should I take it? Because the risk is I'm going to get sued by someone else down the line who's not a part of this patent pool, and I'm going to be litigating all these issues again. So I think that's the challenge. I think MPEG is a pool where most of the industry players believe that most of the essential patents of that standard are in that pool. And then, you know, on the flip side, the challenge is for pools related to other standards where there are only, you know, 10 patents or 8 patents or, and RAND is not feasible in the business model. It becomes that tension of, well, I have no incentive. I have to comply with the standard in order to compete in the industry. And I have no incentive to take this patent pool royalty because, one, my competitors aren't, and two, I have a high risk of some outlier who's not part of this patent pool suing me, and so I can't bear the stacking of the royalties.
Yeah, interesting. MPEG was a different, when that was set up, and actually Cable Labs helped set that up initially. That was done a little bit differently, and maybe that's why there's so many people in the pool, mm-hmm. and it's a fairly complete pool, is there was actually a patent search mm-hmm. done. Once the standard was complete, actually did a patent search to go out and find, go looking for them. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of standards, what they will do is, once the standard is complete, we'll just announce to the world, tell us if you have any IPR, and some people come forward, some people don't, mm-hmm. Some people never see the notice, so they become these incomplete pools. And then, yeah, you are faced with an odd situation because even if you get the pool license, you may have 10 others that are outside the pool, and you're going to have to litigate all those, too. I think it becomes a problem, though, if there is a patent that is not essential in the pool. I think there was an LG case on that. I don't do much litigation anymore, but there could be an antitrust problem. And I also think, I don't know if there's any antitrust problem, too, if it's for as non-essential or optional provisions of the standard that maybe your product doesn't implement, but you're given you're only given one license, and you have a license to all of, you have to take all of them, all or none, generally from the pools.
Yeah, the Federal Circuit to date has not said that that's a problem. So okay, they've said that patent pools are valid, that some patents may not actually be essential, but you're
in
buying
your product.
Right, in your product, yeah. But you're buying the whole package.
Yeah.
And you know, in my experience, the frustration for companies really is this stacking problem.
Yeah.
So if they could just say, okay, it's going to cost me 7 cents and no one else is going to come after me,
right.
You know, it becomes more of an issue when you have a product that has, at least in the wireless industry where most of my experience has been with standards, that you have companies that, you know, 20 years because the patent would be expired, but 10 years after their patent's been issued and the patent hasn't done anything, they dig down and they realize, oh, this radio frequency patent actually applies to your wireless and to your wireless cart that you've now sold for the last 4 years that you've been touting as interoperable. And then suddenly, you know, someone who's not in the patent pool comes to you and says, well, I'll license to you for a reasonable and non-discriminatory rate. I want 7 cents from everybody. But you've already, you know, you've now got 7 cents from LG and 7 cents from Sony and 7 cents. And pretty soon, the issue for the company is, okay, where do I draw the line and where do I have to start litigating these issues because I can't pay 7 cents to everyone who comes through the door and tells me that I have a patent that's essential to the standard.
So one of the stories told about of why open source has become a useful development model now at this point, or maybe 10 years ago, different from what it looked like 20 years ago, is the lowering of transaction costs. And Yochai Benkler in particular talks about it's easier to communicate, the internet has made it easier to share code, and so that people can collaborate in what he calls peer production in a way that they face more barriers to earlier. Now, a lot of the standard story that you're telling is also one of lowering transaction costs and through this coordination, making it easier for people to join together and make new products. Maybe it won't be totally free products or royalty-free products, but at least reasonably licensed products. So do you see standards, either de facto standards or the standards of standard-setting organizations sort of helping in the free software development?
So I've participated in the development of a couple of CEA standards. The CEA is the Consumer Electronics Agency. They may be best known for putting on the Consumer Electronics Show in January in Las Vegas. But one part of their organization manages some technical standards for television, for communication with display devices. There's another group that does the broadcast television standards, and for home networking and for some other uses as well. Recently, more of the standards that I've participated in within CEA and in some other groups begin to include software, either as a reference design or as a test suite or as examples of how one might provide code in a standard. There is, I think, some qualitative differences between, let's say, a protocol standard that tells two devices how to communicate and maybe a standard that describes how you should measure something, or a standard that leads to product safety. There may be laws actually written that over time let's take a look at a car manufacturer who may or may not have software that causes problems.
I can't imagine any of those.
But software is everywhere. In my mind, the software industry is not yet at the level of engineering discipline that electrical, mechanical, civil engineers have been for many decades, many hundreds of years. As the software disciplines become more of an engineering discipline, as you have provable metrics and as we figure out what the heck we're going to do with a billion lines of code written every year, that some percentage of which is to accomplish the same problem that another billion line was written last year, we may see some more certainty for companies to be able to participate and expect they're not going to have somebody knock on the door. Or they will, for sure, because they're in a particular area. So there's a tension, I think, in the maturity of the process for a lot of where standards are done in talking about ones and zeros over a wire and trying to do something cool with the ones and zeros that come over the wire.
I think you bring up an interesting point. You know, our standards do, I think, tend to serve some of the objectives of open source software, community, interoperability, and collaboration to draft the standard. And it's interesting, there is a new consortium out there, the Open Web Foundation, which actually Microsoft is a part of, and helped to get that off the ground. It's kind of like it's an open source model for drafting specifications, to put it in a sentence, I guess. I think it's OFA.org on the web, but they have a patent agreement or an IPR agreement that sets up cross or non-assert for patents. Of course, your copyright licenses, and it's kind of an interesting approach, more of an open blending of open source models and drafting of standards.
I think about the sort of putting open source and standards side by side. I mean, John said something earlier that resonated that I'll repeat, which is a standard is about picking one of several ways to accomplish a particular goal for the purposes of agreeing most likely in our field for interoperability purposes. And while you may have a reference implementation, and you may, the org may decide to license that reference implementation out under an open source license, the important thing is that the reference implementation should never be considered the standard, and here's why. There are usually, you know, 7 to 10 ways to do a particular, to implement a particular portion of a standard. And if you've got multiple sections of the standard, what you're really talking about at the end of the day, there are lots of different ways to write an implementation that complies with that specification. Part of what happens over time, actually, is innovation in the way that you implement pieces of that specification. In fact, sometimes you find out the specification wasn't written very well, and so you push back into the standards organization amendments that actually improve the way that the specification's written and actually improve the way all of the implementations work. And so I think it's really important to draw a line between the two, because if you were to say, you know, the standard is this bunch of code and I'm just going to throw it out there, you take away one of these very important dynamics of what happens in SSOs, which is hard work on the specification, aside from the hard work on the code itself.
Actually, I would add a third element to that. The way we do it at Cable Labs anyway, there's kind of three legs to the stool. There's the standard, the reference implementation, and then a test suite.
Yep.
And the way we release a specification is all three of those have to be there at the same level. We don't release the spec until we have a reference that actually verifies the spec. And then the spec is also verified by the test suite, where you can actually test a product. So you have to have all three. And that was one of our considerations, you know, when we decided, well, you know, we are a standards organization, we want interoperability, there kind of does have to be one person to interpret that, and at least for the area that we operate in, for our specs, we are it. We had some consternation about, well, what if we offer our source code or the reference implementation out with open source? You've lost control of it. But we operate similar to the way Sun does as well, with we keep the test suite and we keep certification, and the specification is Cable Labs. The reference implementation is in the open source community. So you still can have a definitive standard and open source your software without losing the standard under open source.
And I think you bring up a really interesting point, which is this tension between the right of a recipient of open source code to do whatever they want, including compatibility. I mean,
they can do whatever they want.
What we typically hold very dear at a standard setting organization, which is if you're going to be part of this thing, whether it's through a certification and testing scheme or through a patent license, we'll say, you know, I'm only going to let you do this to the extent you're compatible.
I'm only
going to give you the IPR license if you're compatible
with
the standard, because I don't want to be licensing people who are going out and breaking compatibility with all of the hard work we've done here.
Right.
You know, I want to get back. I want to ask, well, answer a question you asked before.
Thank you.
And it sort of went down and back, and I'm not sure people hit it hard. But, you know, it was one of the reasons I put in my last slide the questions about, you know, do you not want to pay? Can you not pay? Are you precluded because of license terms from paying? I think that's really important. So, you know, while I respect the models that free software developers have come up with, I also understand that further downstream, very often, these pieces of code are being picked up and they're incorporated into, you know, it's big business. And so one of the important things to remember is, as John pointed out, people who are inventing this technology, you know, it's one thing to say, oh, there's an open source community that's using that technology in their code. It's a whole other thing to say, you know, there's a Fortune 50 company that's incorporated that technology via some open source code into some products, and maybe it's not selling them, maybe it is selling them, but it's certainly making a lot of money off of that. And so I think that's important. You know, I do understand there's some people who philosophically are, you know, don't like the patent system. And so that's certainly one approach. I think there are a couple of the licenses where there may be some challenges with the exact way the licensing terms work out. But then I think there are certainly some of the noise is certainly people who, for their own business model reasons, would rather not pay royalties. And that's something that we should be very clear about. It's fine if you want to take that position, but I think it's you know, it's disingenuous to not set out a full catalog of why people have concerns here.
Yeah, thank you for bringing those to a head, that we might just find places where there are incompatibilities and where it's difficult to square the two, so you need to step out entirely from the pool of patented technologies if you're trying to develop something freely redistributable.
Well, even there, it's difficult. I mean, the other thing, and John mentioned this quickly, was the idea that, I'll say it a little different terms. It's really important that an SSO attract both the best technology. That's really important. I mean, if you talk to the engineers who are going there, you want to bring in this group of people that's going to make the best technology. But you'll also hear from a lot of companies that it's really important that they bring in the innovators in that area that have IP. We'd rather have those people in there in the organization making a RAND commitment than not. And I say this as a company that really is a net implementer of standards. In other words, we're more on the side of you know, having to take licenses than asking for them. And so, from my perspective, if you do things, if you change the system in a way that winds up driving some of these innovators and IP holders out of the system, what you get is actually a worse outcome.
That's a very good point. Yeah. The goal of every standard-setting body, standards development organizations, SDO is another acronym that's thrown about, is always to develop the best standard possible. Either the most efficient or the highest bandwidth, whatever the particular problem you're trying to solve. But a standards body can only produce quality output based on the input of its members. So much like an open source project, if no one comes in with the latest and greatest ideas, then what's produced as a standard may fail. I have helped write and voted for more than half a dozen standards that I don't believe have been implemented by anybody. Successors to those standards may have been implemented. They may have sparked some further ideas, but it's in some sense a hit and miss. And this is what has driven, I think, a lot of companies away from, you know, to participate in other bodies like the DEC or other technology consortia, where there's a perception that standards are inefficient. Doesn't have to be that way. There's also some perceptions that people are in standards bodies to make sure their IPR shows up in the final standard. Also doesn't have to be that way, and frankly, that seems to be, at least in the standards bodies I'm familiar with, kind of a minority. On the other hand, if you're dealing with trying to standardize some brand new breaking technology and you want the best possible thing, you're likely to bring in the companies that have just submitted for patents in exactly that area. The two are going to go hand in hand. You have to deal with this as clearly as you can. I believe over time, standards bodies may do a better job of describing exactly which IPR is in what part of the standard. I think for many years, MPEG maybe is a good example, there was kind of a, okay, it's in there, we all know the rules, and over time the rules have changed. There are more actors in the field now than the people who were involved in setting and writing the standard, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And as a defensive matter, as a survival, I think standards bodies are going to have to say, okay, here's what we know about the standard, here's what patents we know about, and here's where we think the links exist. If standards bodies don't do that, then they will probably kind of go away and we'll see everything is in the cloud and all the innovation is locked. And that would be a shame. The standards serve a very necessary purpose for a lot of us. I also did want to mention EchoStar has been a developer of set-top boxes that use Linux for most of this decade. We comply with the license and have posted back to the community any changes, any things that we've found that either we've modified as part of our deployment or bug fixes, et cetera. So in terms of participating in the open source side, we understand at least some of those rules and, you know, do our best to play by those rules as well as the standards rules.
Yeah, and I think that's a helpful point that you raised just earlier about standards being a way to open up at a different layer of the technology, that it's opening up the specification and the interface in a way that without some of these protections, some of the developers might choose to keep closed. So I want to ask one last question sort of down the line of, from your perspective in the field, is there one place where you would change the law or policy around the patent standard intersection?
You know, from a litigation standpoint, I think the courts are already doing it. You'll see that there are cases that are arising where patents have not been disclosed during the standard setting process, and now there's a counterclaim of patent misuse. And so I think, and probably because I am a litigator, litigators are really creative about trying to figure out what how to fit the pieces together. I will say that sort of a lot of these cases are just now percolating. The Federal Circuit came out with Dynacor that sort of said in dicta offhand, you can prove infringement just by compliance with the standard. Sort of from an academic point of view, that seems like a good idea, but it only seems to work when the patents are clearly part of the standard or have been disclosed during the standard process. It seems to I think generate a lot more issues when you have a patent that hasn't been disclosed, or you have a patent standard setting or a standard setting body that doesn't have a very strong patent policy for disclosure. So a lot of these standards bodies say, you know, you just tell us what you think may be essential. You don't have to tell us how. And you just give us some sort of guarantee that you'll license it at a brand, and we'll all be good. Because, you know, these organizations are groups of engineers. They're not groups of lawyers. And you can't really expect them to have these very flourishing patent policies that are, you know, going to process a lawyer is going to process the patent as it comes in and figure out what it is essential to. I think John's absolutely right. As I think in at least litigation, there will be some interplay of litigation that forces changes in standard setting bodies because of what courts say about what can and can't happen. And then there will be some things that litigators will just deal with once they happen, because otherwise we wouldn't have jobs.
Well, you all won't.
I mean, I guess I got a couple things I'd add in there. One is, you know, we've heard a lot. We haven't really talked about it here because we talked about sort of the intersection of open source and patents. We didn't talk very much about the intersection of patents and standards. And what you'd probably hear from a lot of people, if you put a panel of four people up to talk about that, you'd hear a lot about patent holdup and the fact that this is a real problem right now. In response to your question about is new law needed, I mean, I look at this from a sort of legal philosophy standpoint, which is, you know, do we let, are those cases that we're hearing about, the Rambus, the Qualcomm, those other cases, are those the edge cases, which are, in my opinion, I think they are, and I think they're also just commercial disputes between participants in the standard setting system. They're not disputes between society and participants or non-participants and participants. And so one of the concerns I have is with letting edge cases like that actually define the direction that you want the law to go in. In other words, we have courts for a reason. Courts are great at dealing with commercial disputes, and some have said jobs because of that. So I think it's important to think about that before we sort of go waving any, you know, real big ideas for change there. The second thing, and I think there's an interesting paper on this. Mark Lemley wrote something like 10 things to do and one not to do. And the one not to do, I was like, hallelujah, when I saw him say this. He said, you know, don't pick up that big club of antitrust law and go waving that around. There's a whole bunch of things that you want to look at before then. And I would actually say within his 10 things, some pretty decent ideas. And a lot of them aren't really about changing the law. They're about things like John referenced, you know, the participants really want more crispness. I mean, I want to know. I want to know, first of all, who has any IP in the standards I'm participating in. I'd love to know more about it, more specifically about it, but I want people to at least identify that. So, you know, there is room for improvement. Is that a legal change that requires a legislative change or a court change? I don't think so. I think it's fine-tuning SSO policies and compliance with those policies that's certainly going to be helpful in those areas.
Just a comment on that. I do see a lot of SSO policies changing to at least encourage a priori disclosure of IP under the IP policy. So some of them have been redrafted, I think, even to require that. So it's not really a law change. Like you said, it's an SSO mm-hmm. policy change. The area I would maybe pick up on is more of a question or that I would throw out there. It was something I don't remember somebody said is, you know, what happens when you are mandated to comply with a standard? So let's take the ATSC standard for digital broadcast. The FCC says you must comply with this, TV manufacturers or all these other manufacturers. And now Patent Troll comes out of the woodwork and says, I have patents on that. They were not part of the process. They were not part of the SSO, ATSC. They are just a complete patent holdup. They could even get injunctive relief if they actually made a product. But, you know, is there a case where, like you said, I think fair use, maybe there's got to be some fair use when there's a government-mandated standard and a patent troll is holding up society?
The other question is, I mean, it's just a should governments be mandating standards in that manner in the first place?
Yeah.
That's
a different panel.
But seriously, there are reasons for government agencies
to
mandate standards
select areas.
Yeah,
yeah.
Society benefits as a whole. So to answer your question, what would I like to see change? Let me tell a little story about a conversation that I've been on both sides of now. In CEA's process, they actually have CEA staff who takes notes and runs the meeting, and then there's a chair of a working group addressing a particular problem. If it happens that somebody during the conversation about let's solve this problem by doing X, Y, or Z, if somebody mentions that, well, it's going to cost 2 cents per chip to do that and 4 cents per chip to do the other thing, the immediate response from CEA staff is going to be, you can't talk about dollars and cents. There's no monetary discussion whatsoever in this standards organization. Well, sometimes what you really want to talk about is, if I do X, I'm going to have to hire 12 engineers to solve it, and if I do Y, I'm going to go hire one guy out of college and he'll solve it that way. So engineers being engineers have come up with a way to talk about complexity, which nearly always is proportional to cost. And it is a technical term. So let's say we figured out a way around maybe some overreaching antitrust or overreaching court cases to still do what we have to do, which is figure out for our industry, for our companies, what the better solution is going to be without straying into what we are told by our legal advisors is, you know, Don't talk about cost, right? We'll figure out a way to do that. I do think that given that we have, say, ANSI and accredited processes in place, there ought to be some public policy discussions about, okay, you guys don't have to talk in code words if that's what's going on. You can't actually talk about, well, these 5 patents versus those 2 patents, I'd rather do the 2 patents but not today because it turns out the second patent is twice as expensive as any of the other 5. So, to be realistic, in today's society, there is a change that needs to happen. We're the engineers, though. We're going to follow our wise legal advisors and continue forwards under what we do. In the case of open source, I don't know who's providing that legal advice in the open source community. There are some groups who absolutely are doing that. But as a whole, as an open source developer, I would be... If I knew what I knew about standards processes, I would shut off my computer and go play Frisbee. So,
Okay, and a few more minutes before everyone can go out and play Frisbee. Do we have some questions from the audience?
I'd like to address this to John and Jeff. The issue is that for standards, particularly where patents are involved, they become complex engineering and legal matters, which now tend to be heard by people who have magna cum laude's in poetry writing. And my question is, how do you feel about the possibility of having some kind of enforcement standard which would require such matters to binding ABR?
Your last acronym, again, not the lawyer?
Alternative dispute resolution.
Got it, okay. Arbitration. Oh, got it. Yeah. Thank you. I understand. Do you want to start?
I think, like I said, that you can have contractual agreements outside of standards organizations, LLCs, other agreements. Even Cable Labs has IPR agreements where you could mandate ADR within and among the people who are signatory to that contract. Now, you can't buying third parties that are not part of the standard-making process.
But Judd, that wasn't my question.
Yeah. Okay.
My question is not the legalese involved, but rather how you feel about this being part of standards organizations, whether or not that you would feel that it would be advantageous or disadvantageous.
So, two observations. One, this is, I think, as Judd mentions, this is the reason why some consortia are formed not as standards bodies, but as LLCs. And as part of their bylaws, that's oftentimes a part of what the members are doing. And good outreach means that you'll probably have nearly everybody involved anyway who might show up. Secondly, yes, I think that given the number of cases that I'm aware of that involve standards, again, as an engineer, and the billions of dollars, when all is said and done with all of the actors that were wasted, I do think that is a very good public policy. That might be the right way to resolve some of these issues, to force someone to say, yeah, my three standards I'm bringing in are these parts and not any of those other parts.
Then my question is, why isn't it being done?
So who do you imagine would do that? That's the problem.
What? The standards bodies would be adopters and enforcers.
So the engineers that are sitting on the R7 Home Networking Standards Committee, you think are going to be able to draft this?
Or if their council. Then they have to draft it. I'm an arbitrator.
I understand. So, a lot of the participants in standard settings, a lot of the time participation in a due process standards organization is open to anybody for free or very nominal cost to keep the lights on. What that means is my company sends me solely to meetings around the globe, and I don't have a staff of 12 to cover all of the standards bodies that I cover. I have a staff of one. For a company then to pull in a litigator or contract lawyer or somebody else in legal doubles their cost of participating in standards, that means, why bother to go to that standards organization? They're going through all these weird changes. I don't know what's going to happen in the end. My cost, you know, why am I doing this anyway? What good are standards? I'm just going to buy products anyhow. So there's no motivation to do what you describe from the, say, corporate benefit. There's no clear benefit to date. I think if someone wants to write a paper about it, and if I hear about that, I would be happy to send it to our CEO and CFO and say, hey, guys, look, maybe these are some good ideas. Maybe I ought to be talking about this at the next meeting of the standards body as a whole see if these things happen.
You've hit on something that we see with a lot of proposals. They're good ideas, but what they wind up being is bring your lawyer to work for you guys, for the technical guys. There are a number of these, and so, you know, they're hitting roadblocks and in that respect, because it's costly just to send you as an engineer around the world to all of these, and to be also sending a lawyer along with you is a tough one.
Sometimes, if there was a model process, maybe ANSI is the right organization to bring this to. If a group of litigators decided they had a good idea and brought it to ANSI, I'm sure ANSI would listen to it.
I guess that's what baffles me, John, because there is a model process, and I'm puzzled over why it isn't widely adopted.
I don't know about it, and I'm the guy that's sitting in the committee. So now that I'm learning about it, this may lead to some discussion. So, I mean, the problem is communications is the reason why.
So this sounds like a good conversation for cocktail hour follow-up. We've got a few more I see in the audience. I saw one over here.
That's okay. I think there have been some really interesting observations that, Steve, when you talked about not using reference implementations, having been involved with both with IETF, implementations of IETF, implementations of CCITT, and implementations of SAE, Society of Automotive Engineers, the usability or the referenceability of a standard to actually do an implementation varies widely, right? And as John so cogently observed, garbage in yields indeterminate results on the output. So I think it's curious that you observed that the standard is not the reference implementation and vice versa. It would seem to me, that the language that's being used for standards, when I've dealt with SDL, which is the modeling language in CCITT for implementation, you could create some machinery to automatically produce the code to do that kind of standard implementation, which would give you some really bulletproof style implementations, at least for conformance, if not for performance, right? And that seems to me to be something that would be extremely useful in most standard bodies, is to use language that was a machine amenable, right, in order to actually produce working implementations.
I mean, it's a little bit outside of my domain because I'm not a sort of the technical guy who goes and creates standards, but I take your point, which is that not all specifications are well written. And I think really the key there is that, you know, whether it's for rushing it out the door because companies are already selling implementations of it and they want to be able to point to an actual standard specification or whatever the reasons are. I mean, I think there are definitely ways to advance the state of the specification. Hopefully, as V2, V3, V4, you know, whatever gets worked on, it gets better and better. My only point, and it wasn't really to say that reference implementations aren't a good thing. They are a good thing. I think they're a starting point. They're helpful for conformance testing. They're helpful for interoperability testing. But at the end of the day, I think it's important to separate the specification from some running code that happens to be one of many ways you could implement that specification.
So I've seen what you describe in some targeted standards areas where it makes a lot of sense. But now I'm trying to envision, how do I talk to my legal department about a standard that describes a machine algorithm that I understand the purpose of and I understand the protocol, but I wasn't the guy that coded the translator, the compiler, that may or may not have bugs in it, and that I'm sure when I look at the ones and zeros on the wire, our implementation is right, and everybody who's using the Mark X Quasimodo compiler is wrong, but we got to conform to that and not to the standard.
Right, so you
fix the standard.
That's the issue about maturity in the industry itself.
I think we will see more and more of what you describe over time, yeah. in some areas. I don't know when we're going to see that for a cable standard, it's a physical wire cable standard.
Especially in the software area, you can automate a lot of steps, you know, especially if it's in Java, and you can create the Java signatures, and then from the signatures you can create, you know, your jar files and et cetera. It gets fairly...
So,
yeah.
I apologize, I'm getting the standard indication that it's time for us to wrap up here, and I want to make sure we thank very much all of the participants here on this panel and those before us.
Give me 1 minute. I was hovering in the wings, and then Anna Noskezi just said, the alcohol's not here yet. The food is here, though, and so I think we've had a really long and very productive set of sessions. I did want to mark that this is the last event of the year for Silicon Flatirons, and we had a really great year, and I think that you know, this was our first year without Phil Weiser running it, and I think we just had so many positive things happen in the center. And I think we applaud for a lot of people at the conferences. We rarely applaud for the community. And tonight was a great example of a lot of people coming out to listen to some really interesting but very technical discussions. And so please join me in thanking all of you for being such a good audience with us. The last rule, I'm all about rules, the last rule we always have at Silicon Flatirons is if you find a beer to hold while you're in the reception, please try and find a student, there are only a few in the room, to talk about what you do, and especially if you have jobs in this uncertain market, please do try and seek out our students, they're wonderful. Thank you very much once again.